we have a transparent citizenry where information about individuals tends to be widely available. It's easy to aggregate that information and very quickly develop a detailed portrait of someone's life, their habits, what they do, who they're friends with, where they go. Lots of data is now bought and sold about individuals without their knowledge and in ways that many individuals would find objectionable.
How careful would you be if you knew someone was listening to your public conversations and using that information for their own purposes? That's essentially what's happening in any of your movements online. Your chatter on Twitter and Facebook is essentially a lunchroom conversation etched in stone. And it goes deeper these days. A ton of data that was previously obscure is now free-floating. Your address and utility records, your diaries and photos, travel itineraries and purchases, any information you've entered into a web form or text box, heck, any information that someone else publishes about you, can be shared, sold, subpoenaed, or repurposed for any number of uses. From the merely annoying and creepy, in the case of marketing, to a threat to your well-being, in the case of a lawsuit or identity theft. In the digital age, the database is a powerful weapon for transparency, but its ease of use is also a tyrannical force against any desire you might have to remain anonymous. Joel R. Reidenberg is the academic director of the Center on Law and Information Policy at Fordham University. He believes that transparency can be a threat to the public good, and suggests that we try to re-engineer some obscurity back into our digital life.
Privacy in the United States has a very unusual history in a way. We lump a lot of different interests into the term privacy. In the United States, we don't have an explicit constitutional right to privacy. Privacy has been interpreted in the penumbra of rights in the Bill of Rights. And what it means is in the U.S., we lump a whole series of interests into the term privacy. So we lump into it privacy in one's home. We lump into it reproductive freedom as a question of privacy, being able to read certain kinds of material becomes a question of privacy. We have in the world of torts a set of, again, distinct interests that we protect through common law. Things like misappropriation of one's name or likeness. It's also known as a right of publicity. It's called a privacy tort. Dissemination of truthful information, but that was obtained by intruding on someone's seclusion. Then we have another privacy tort that's called intrusion upon seclusion. Another privacy tort that is dissemination of information that places someone in a false light. So we have a whole series of different distinct interests being protected, all grouped under this term privacy. Most privacy law in the United States, however, is statutory, and particularly in terms of the private sector, it's almost all statutory. And it comes from a series of laws enacted more or less post-1970s, generally in response to some kind of scandal. Scandal arises, invading someone's privacy results in statute. So, for example, for many years, our video rental records got greater privacy protection in the United States than our health records. Because when Judge Bork was nominated to be a Supreme Court justice, one of the Washington newspapers found his video rental records. And that became a big scandal. Congress passed a law protecting video rental records. But at the same time, health records were completely unprotected from by privacy legislation. So we're very reactive in the United States.
That's interesting that that privacy in the United States is something that has changed over time, that there is an inherent constitutional notion of privacy that hasn't changed at all.
And the constitutional notion changes over time because the doctrine under the Fourth Amendment is reasonable expectation of privacy, right? That's a touchstone. If citizens have a reasonable expectation of privacy, then the state needs a warrant for a search. Well, what's a reasonable expectation of privacy? Society's notions of reasonable expectations can change over time. So what you or I think is private information, our children might not.
And this gets into the area that you talk about of the current age of the transparent citizen. Can you describe a little bit about what that means?
Yeah, we've reached a point with the kind of information that circulates on the internet today and that's available online. We have a transparent citizenry where information about individuals tends to be widely available, can be aggregated to create very detailed portraits, profiles, or dossiers, if you will, of individuals. So discrete pieces of information happen to be on the net for one reason or another. If someone owns a home, that'll be recorded as part of the land record that's often now available on the net. If someone's mentioned in the newspaper, whatever the particular fact that got them in the newspaper is now publicly available. Individual or someone's friends post about them on a blog, mention them, use an email address, a class newsletter, reports on someone's activities or someone's family. All of these things that wind their way onto the net individually, they're discrete pieces of information that are disclosed in a particular context. For most people, seems pretty innocuous. But now, with search engines, it's easy to aggregate that information and very quickly develop a detailed portrait of someone's life, their habits, what they do, who they're friends with, where they go. That's the kind of transparency we're now seeing in society.
How has this information been accessed or used that raises questions or makes people uncomfortable?
Well, there are two levels to the kinds of access or dissemination of this information. One is by the government. So as private sector actors collect more and more information about individuals through their transactions, through interactions of one sort or another, that information winds up in a commercial marketplace of personal information. There's a very robust marketplace of companies that sell data about individuals that are gleaned from a myriad of sources. The government purchases that data. They purchase it in many instances. Most of the recent cases that are publicly known deal with security and safety. So we have fusion centers. These are centers set up to enable data sharing between local and state law enforcement officials in the federal government. Fusion centers, one of their functions is to acquire data from the private sector about individual, broad-scale individuals' activities. So there's a degree of state surveillance that occurs because this transparent information is sold to the government. On the private sector side, the marketplace itself of personal information, lots of data is now bought and sold about individuals without their knowledge. And in ways that most individuals, many individuals would find objectionable.
But if this information is out there anyway, if I'm sometime, in some cases, voluntarily giving this up in the case of a Facebook status update, do I just forego my right to, you know, not be surveilled by the government or these commercial interests?
Well, this is the difficulty now. In participating in the online world, unless participants are very careful about things like their privacy settings on Facebook. The answer is yes. Unwittingly, many people are giving up any sense of privacy that they might otherwise have had because they're putting information out publicly like that. You know, there's a famous case that occurred this summer. The wife of the British Intelligence Service's incoming head posted family vacation pictures on Facebook, not realizing that the settings were done in a way that the world was able to see the family photos, compromising the family safety. Those kind of examples, most users, even though they're putting information out there, they're not in a position to know how it will circulate, where it will be used, who's buying and selling it. That happens often behind closed doors or behind disclosure statements that are so vague they're meaningless.
So that the person who's giving up their data just can't understand what they're doing, that they're completely lifting the veil on their world and letting everybody see.
They're lifting the veil because in part there's an immediate reason why they want to disclose the data. That's known. It's a future compromise of that data that's going to happen. So the individual is quite rationally discounting what the risk is because they don't know about the risk. The risk is in the future, if they're even aware of it. There was a great study that was done, released last fall, by Berkeley and the Annenberg School at University of Pennsylvania, that showed, the statistic was 62% of web users think that when they see a website has a privacy policy, they believe it means that the site won't disclose their information to third parties just because there's a privacy policy. That's wrong. That's completely wrong. So the majority of web users misunderstand what it means to disclose information to a website that has a privacy policy.
And what are the solutions to that? Is that just a public education problem, or is it a legal problem?
I think it's both. I think it's in part a public education problem. I think the public has to become more cognizant of how information circulates and what some of the consequences are. But it's a world where there's asymmetry of information. The organizations collecting the data are often three or four layers away from the individual who's disclosing. So there's almost no way a disclosure, a notice, can be made to the internet user in a way that person's really going to properly be able to appreciate what the risks are. That's the instance where law typically comes in and begins to set normative bounds for society.
You talk about trying to re-engineer obscurity. And I wonder if you can unpack that concept a little bit for me.
Sure. In the past, we had a lot of information that was publicly available in a technical sense. So the quintessential example would be a property record. Property records in the United States have long been matters of public record. But to find a property record, a researcher would have to know where the property was located, go to the county courthouse or the land record office for that region, and look through some dusty books to find it. But they would be able to. It was publicly available. Now that data is online. A couple of clicks of a search engine and you find it. What it means is the use of that information was there, but as a practical matter, it was obscure. So there was a degree of privacy protection in its obscurity. Someone really needed and wanted to know very badly the information in the property record to make the effort to go to the courthouse, go through the books, and find it. Online, that constraint is gone. So we've lost practical obscurity. What it now means is that lots of public information, and the government collects a lot of information about citizens and its matters of public record, lots of public information now is out there linkable and identifiable to individuals in ways that affect their privacy, in ways where their privacy is affected like it's never been affected before. So one of the things I think we need to begin to focus on is how do we re-engineer the network ecosystem to restore some of the practical obscurity that enables us to persist in having publicly available records for the uses that they must be publicly available, and minimize the adverse consequences to privacy and to citizens participating in the democracy by having too much information out there about individual citizens available for any use.
But I wonder about what some of those uses are and whether some might argue that we've found some amazing benefits having access to that information and some possible commercial, public, social or otherwise applications that we never would have thought of before.
Sure. There will always be good reasons to justify sharing and data mining personal information. I certainly wouldn't challenge that. There are always good reasons for it. What I do challenge is that there is a cost to that. There is a major privacy cost to that. And that privacy cost undermines fundamental notions we have of democracy. And do we want innovation over democratic values? I think we have to come down in a way that is more supportive of democratic values than we have been doing for the last decade or two.
The idea that this could actually challenge democracy, that there is a threat to our way of life. I'm interested in the counter argument to that you know, a privacy libertarian might argue that we should open it up to, you know, let people share with the world and not have any issue.
Well, the typical counter argument is if you have nothing to hide, you shouldn't be worried about it. That's one. Another typical counter argument is, well, let the marketplace sort this out. This is really, we don't want the government stepping in and telling us how we should treat information as private or not private. That should really be a collection of individual decisions. If you look at, you know, we have nothing to hide, so what's the problem? Well, the answer is that's contrary to very core democratic values, which says that we ought to be able to engage in anonymous speech, for example. We have freedom of association, and the degree to which we can't choose when and what to disclose, to whom, affects our ability to have our freedom of association. Because of data mining, if I'm a member of a group of 100 people, and 75 members of those group turns out to be willing to disclose lots of personal information. Through data mining, it enables someone to identify attributes and characteristics of me, even though I've not consented to it. So there's an externality, a third-party effect that's quite significant. Another good illustration for that is DNA. Suppose you have nothing to hide. And you decide it's perfectly fine to have your DNA published on the web. That's great. But now you've compromised your relatives' ability to keep the DNA confidential because your DNA tells the story about your parents, your siblings, your descendants, other members of your family. So individual's decision in that instance is implicating the privacy rights of others. So that's sort of one of the typical things that it's very challenging in this environment.
And there's also an aspect of this that the genie's already out of the bottle, and it sounds like that the law has to go back and kind of make up for something it was kind of overlooking, as the net as being its own ecosystem and a place where the members of the community could make up their own rules, and not something that would have implications, you know, outside of its own little sphere. And now the legal structures have to catch up.
Well, there's certainly an evolution taking place right now. The social consensus on privacy and how to deal with privacy, whether it's going to be through government regulation, through technological regulation, or through pure private law or marketplace decision making, that's evolving right now. What the boundaries are for private information, public information, is also evolving right now. So in that sense, while the genie's partway out of the bottle, I wouldn't say it's completely out of the bottle because it's not clear how our society is going to answer some of these questions. It's been answered quite differently outside the United States. In Europe, it's been answered with a far more regulatory approach to data privacy. It focuses on legitimizing data collection and uses through regulatory authorization in a way that we haven't done in the United States. The most advanced are probably the European states through the European Union and the European Union's Directive on Data Privacy. That model has been followed more widely outside of Europe than the American model, which is very patchwork and piecemeal and reactive to particular kinds of scandals. In some other countries, there have been experiments with combinations of law and law sanctioned self-regulation. So you see some models in even within Europe, but also in Canada, in the Netherlands, which sparked some of the European thinking on it.
What are some of the other kinds of you were talking about technological solutions we could apply to this?
Yeah, we can begin. I think we need to begin thinking about how technology can be developed and deployed that tags information and information uses, so that we focus. So, for example, in the data privacy realm, if information is made available to a group of the public, I'll say a group of the public. I'm thinking of something like, you know, a Facebook or social network site where information is made available to a social network. The poster often has an expectation that it's being used within that social network for a set of purposes. We need to begin to think about technologies that will be able to distinguish uses that are based on the context for which the data was disclosed, such that secondary uses get blocked. And we begin to reinstantiate practical obscurity, notions of privacy, into the network ecosystem itself.
Can you give an example of that? A piece of data that might be put out on Facebook that you could tag and say, this cannot be used for any other purpose?
Sure. Well, we think photographs, for instance. People put up their photographs, they tag the photograph with the name. We could envision a regime where the photograph itself or the name tag can only be displayed in the context of that particular Facebook page. Attempts to take that photograph off of Facebook and put it on a blog someplace else either get blocked or are automatically reported back to the person who posted the photograph. So things like that. I mean, there's a case in New York that occurred last summer of a model who was defamed on a pseudonymous blog. It was a blog called The Skankiest in New York City. And this model was being disparaged and attacked on this blog. One of the things that the blogger did was to take a photo off of the model's Facebook page and put it on the blog. And comment on the blog completely out of context from the way in which it was posted on the Facebook page. And commented on the blog that made the model sound and look terrible. And that was part of the claim that this was the way this was done was defamatory. So if you think about the contextual integrity of the photograph, which is a term Helen Nissenbaum has popularized for privacy, one could envision a technological infrastructure that either blocks the transposition of the photo from the Facebook page into another blog site, or alternatively, when that photo is taken and placed on the other blog site, it automatically notifies the poster. Or in transposing it, it automatically strips out the identifying characteristics. I mean, we see that Google Earth, for example, outside the United States, if you look at pictures on Google Earth, it blurs faces because regulatory agencies in France, one example, Canada is another, have required Google to blur the faces. Well, Google has a technology. They don't do it, you know, there isn't a person at Google sitting there looking at every image on Google Earth trying to find faces. No, it's automated. They have a technology that does facial recognition. It sees that it's a face and it blurs it. Well, we can envision that kind of concept morphing to, you know, data being moved out of one context into another.
Well, here in the United States, in that particular example of Google, they've gone to the effort of blurring out license plates on cars. Mm-hmm. In that case, I imagine that's because of a legal reason. But if they have the ability to blur out faces, and they can do that in other countries, why wouldn't they just err on the side of caution or err on the side of, you know, the most sensitive criticism they could get and just blur out the faces here in the United States as well?
I think you'd probably have to ask Google that. But it takes effort to do that. Unless there's an incentive, I mean, that gets back to how do you accomplish this? Do you do it by leaving it to the marketplace? Well, if you leave it to the marketplace, Google needs a marketplace incentive to do it. Marketplace incentives, there's money. Money, the sale of personal information is a multi-billion dollar business in the United States. So there's a lot of money at stake over whether personal information can be bought and sold. If you don't leave it to the marketplace and say, well, the law may provide the incentive by requiring it. That's what happened outside the United States.
Well, this is a very interesting topic, and it raises a lot of very provocative and interesting questions that I hope we can have you back again after you've published your article, maybe after you've published your book as well.
Thank you. That'd be great fun.
Joel R. Reidenberg is the academic director of the Center on Law and Information Policy at Fordham University. He keeps his own digital dossier online, which you can find a link to at our website, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. Today's episode was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, with the help of the Law Lab at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.